I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. Tim O'Brien's memories of the Vietnam War are never far off, even more than 40 years after the conflict's end. That may be why the book he wrote about it has seen such success and still makes an impression on veterans of nearly every war since. Today, we'll discuss the things they carried. Then, classic board games like Monopoly or Risk may not draw people in like they once did, but Euro-style games are gaining in popularity. Are they the key to pulling us away from our computer screens this fall and actually bonding with each other? Later, we'll run down the weekend to-do list with Brian McTavish. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. All these years later, Tim O'Brien still thinks about Vietnam. It can happen when he hears a helicopter because it was a helicopter that took him into battle those many years ago, and it was a helicopter that brought him out. Memories of his time in Vietnam float back to him out of the blue. He remembers the terror of walking through rice paddies and wondering if maybe his next step would strike a landmine, and that would be that. In so many ways, this is the year of Vietnam, with the big PBS series by Ken Burns and Tim O'Brien's enduring book about the war, The Things They Carried, serving as a centerpiece of The Big Read. That's a 2.5-month initiative that involved all six of Kansas City area's major public libraries. That book, by the way, has sold 7 million copies. Tim O'Brien himself serves as an advisor for the Ken Burns series, and he's speaking in town tonight at the library. And Tim O'Brien joins me right here in the studio. So nice to have you here, Tim. Welcome.
Great pleasure to be here. Thank you.
How surprised are you by all the attention on Vietnam this year? I mean, it's been 40 years since that thing ended.
I am surprised. I think that the attention would not be there if it weren't for Ken's film. It, I think, has awakened America from a kind of sleep that happened after Vietnam. It was a war that America, I think, would prefer to forget.
I was going to say, we don't want to remember this one, do we?
We don't.
Too many problems.
So many, not just in Vietnam itself, but here at home as well. Families divided, you know, protesters walking down in the hundreds of thousands to the Lincoln Memorial, yeah, down the mall. The Kent State shootings, what happened in Chicago at the Democratic Convention. You know, people, policemen hitting protesters over the head with clubs.
Yeah.
So it wasn't just in Vietnam. The whole country was divided, much as we were during the Civil War.
What was your role with the Ken Burns documentary?
Well, not as much as people are saying. It was modest. I attended, I think, five screenings, during which they would, you know, edit the film and make changes and listen. They listened to a panel of advisors, two veterans, myself included, a group of historians, people from Vietnam, and they were so conscientious about trying to get it right. It really, I was so proud of the editors and of Ken and Lynn, who did the co-directing of it. They were determined to do it right, and they took a very risky step by deciding to incorporate the voices of Vietnamese in this film, both on the South and our former enemies in the North.
And what did you think of that?
I thought it was astonishing. To me, the word VC had always meant enemy.
Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't really associated with human beings. And to listen to these people and look at their faces as they're talking about their own experiences, the word enemy no longer really applied.
Yeah.
They were much like my own friends in Vietnam, my buddies I'd walk with, the same fears, the same missing home, wanting to go home so desperately just to be with their families, and yet having to endure this long and terrible war.
You know, I was struck. You have said in the past that while you were over there as an infantryman, very much on the front lines, you hardly saw the enemy. The enemy was just sort of out there, maybe a few fleeting images, but coming face to face and really putting a face on who they were was something that didn't happen to you.
Very true. I was in combat for 9 months or so, and in those 9 months, I only once saw the living enemy holding a weapon, clearly the enemy. I did see, of course, many, many, dozens, even scores of, dead enemy soldiers and dead Americans as well. But only because the war was so chaotic. It's not like in the movies where the hero spots the enemy and takes careful aim and shoots. It was foliage and jungle. Banana trees, and you saw very little. It was chaos. So, in a way, you go to a war, and it's nothing like the war that my father had told me about in World War II.
Mm-hmm. So Ken Burns and what Lynn put together, Lynn was in here talking about it. What do you make of what they came up with, the final product? What's the bottom line for you?
Bottom line is it's educative. America needs to know, I think, its own history.
Yeah.
It's a sad situation when I'll go to colleges and speak and someone will raise a hand and say, you mentioned My Lai. What was that? This terrible massacre that had happened a year before I got there. Or they'll say, oftentimes, what side were we on? North or South? Or they'll say, believe it or not, who won?
Really? Really?
I'm not kidding.
Yeah, yeah.
It was 40 years ago. They often don't get to it in their high school and college history courses because it's later on in the chronology of things. They'll do World War II. They'll go to Korea. But because Vietnam is more recent, they sometimes just run out of time. And then there's the thing that you mentioned, this desire, I think, in America in general, is to erase failure. And it was a failed endeavor. We lost the war. And to erase the divisions of it all and try to, as many psychiatrists urge veterans, just get over it. And
I think this notion of this country trying to forget began immediately. I went to school at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, lots of protests, all kinds of wild stuff going on that campus in the years before I arrived. But when I arrived in 1975 in the fall, nobody was talking about the war.
Yeah.
I remember nothing about it.
Which is very, it's destructive.
It's remarkable.
This self-erasure thing is dangerous, I think. It's easy to think that, well, wars end when you sign a peace treaty. It's all over. But it's not over, and it'll never be over for the mother of a soldier who died over there. She's still waking up at 4 in the morning asking, where's my baby? 40 years later. And the children of veterans are still, especially those who lost their fathers, never even met their fathers in Vietnam. The war will never be over for them or for me. I still think about it and dream about it. I have two young children, 12 and 14, and they're living with a man who is carrying Vietnam with him and always will. You don't just get over things like killing people.
And that's in large part, I'm holding up a copy of your book, The Things They Carried. That's in large part why you wrote this book.
It is.
This book didn't come out until 1990.
Right.
And yet it still sold 7 million copies. Mm-hmm. How do you explain that? Because that doesn't, if I'm your agent, I'm saying, thank you very much, Mr. O'Brien, but we've moved on.
Well, it's a book of stories.
It's
not a history, and I think the answer to your question really has to do with the power of story. It's one thing to speak abstractly about things that happen in the world, but it's another thing to be in your bed at night and open up a book, and you're reading about this character doing that. And if the writing is powerful enough, and if the story is good enough, takes you in. You feel that you're not reading about something, but that you're in something. You're in my boots, slashing through a rice paddy at 4 o'clock in the morning with the moon overhead, and you're scared out of your mind, and you're heading out on ambush, and you're thinking about your legs moving through that landmine stuff
that just might be there.
It just might be there. I think 80% of our casualties came from landmines. And so a story puts you, I think, you're in it if it's a good enough story. Abstraction's tough, you know, just to talk about a war abstractly. It's 40 guys died today in Baghdad. And end of story. It's kind of what you read and what you hear on the news. Mm-hmm. But you don't get their personalities, and you don't get their terror, and you don't get their mothers crying, and you don't get the expectation that father has that somebody's going to be walking up his sidewalk to deliver. You get none of that.
To deliver the news. To
deliver the bad news.
Passed, yeah. Hey, how did you handle yourself, Tim, this terror that came with walking through that rice paddy at 4 o'clock in the morning? How did you deal with that?
Good question. Don't know the answer. Yeah. I know I did. You do it. You deal with those sorts of things on a second-by-second basis. You know, I'll take this half a step, and then if my foot goes down, I'll take the next one, maybe. I think that there's a desire in part not to embarrass yourself. There was always the alternative for any infantryman. You just lie down. What can they do? They can't send you to Nam because you're already there. And somehow, just second by second, you make your legs and your body do things almost without volition or without willpower. There's an automatic feel to it. But in your heart, you're saying, dear God, dear God, dear God, dear God, over and over again, you're so incredibly terrified.
And you're saying you didn't want to embarrass what your comrades, your colleagues, you're there as a unit, and you know if you begin to falter, that might impact them and their ability to put their one foot in front of the other and move
forward. Yeah, that's part of it. And part of it is just simple fear of ridicule. That guy, you know, he didn't behave well under fire. That's not good. Mm-hmm. But mostly it's personal. It's not really your buddies. You're caring about yourself, your sense of dignity and reputation, the person you are. I was opposed to the war. I thought it was wrong from the start. I went anyway. I shouldn't have gone. I think I was a coward for going to that war. I did what looked brave on the surface. It looked, you know, guys going to his war. But inside, I thought I should have said no, and I'll always think that. So there was that complication for me. I'm an anomaly in a way that there were some guys like me there, but not many, at least in my company. Most of them were young, gung-ho, believed their government would never lie to them that this war is being won, that it was a just war. They believed in the rectitude of the war. But I went there a couple of years older than most of my fellow, you know, grunts. And I had come through college, and I demonstrated against the war, and yet still found myself in it for essentially the same reason, that fear of embarrassment and ridicule. I come from a small town, and I didn't want people sitting around the diner saying, did you hear what the O'Brien kid did? You know, he went to Canada, or he went to jail. And imagine my mom and dad hearing that. So that fear of ridicule and embarrassment is a powerful faculty. And I think millions of people go off to fight, not really knowing much about the cause, was it right or wrong, certainly not knowing the political details of, you know, the behind the war, but going to not embarrass themselves by saying no.
Tim O'Brien's my guest. He's the author of The Things They Carry, the national bestseller that continues to have such a big impact on all of us. If you want to join our conversation, 816-235-2888 is the number here. Again, 816-235-2888, or you can tweet us at KCUR up to date. You've said that decision to go to war for yourself, that's the one decision you wish you had back. Even today, you would have done it differently, despite the incredible impact the war has had on you and the success you've had as a result of that war.
Yeah, there's an irony in that.
Yeah.
I mean, I have to live with that irony on top of everything else. It's something I hated. I was bad at it. When I went to basic training, I knew nothing about weapons and nothing about camping.
Yeah.
Hated mosquitoes, hated Boy Scouts, hated it. And there I'm in it. And now I'm known as a writer about war. And it's more than irony. It's keeps me awake thinking, how did I end up being known as a war writer when I despised it so much? And then I think back on other people who've written about war. You know, All Quiet on the Western Front
Sure.
was written by Remarque, who's a man who despised war too. And you know, and he too recognized the irony. So I'm not alone in that. Vonnegut certainly felt that way. I met him a few times over my career as a writer, and he too felt as I do. How did I get into this boat? But what all you can do, I suppose, is you go through the fire and you come home, and well, what do you do with it? And for me, it had to be tell stories, not lecture people, not go into politics, but try to just trust in the power of a story to awaken people's imaginations as to what would you do if you opposed a war? Would you go? Or what would you do if you were in a firefight and somebody yelled for help? Would you risk your life to get up? What would you do if you had a man in your sights and you could shoot him dead? Would you actually do it? It's easy to say yes, but when you're actually in that circumstance, it's far from easy.
Well, maybe all that is the reason you wrote, and maybe it's also because writing about it still helps you deal with it and maybe put some distance between yourself and what that was all about, Tim?
Really well said. That's almost certainly true. That when you are working on a story, you change names, and by just changing a proper noun, a name, it's out of you. It's not you anymore. It's that character on the page. And as the words go down, as the story gets written, you feel like you're putting your emotions on that page. That they're still a kind of inside you, but they're also kind of now outside of you. And I think it's similar to talk therapy that, psychiatrists practice, that you're not going to forget you were in Auschwitz or you had breast cancer or that your wife divorced you or that you were in a war. You're not going to forget it. But by talking about it, or in my case, by writing about it, I think it does lighten the burden.
Yeah. You know, I was struck by something else I read about you, where when you were over there, Tim, that as the day began to reach its end, your buddies would be talking and your comrades would be doing whatever they were doing. You would sort of go off by yourself in the foxhole and grab some paper and a pen and just jot down the events of what happened that day.
I did.
And did you know at the time you were going to be looking ahead and writing about it someday? Or
I thought of it at the time really as leaving some kind of written record for my mom and dad in case I was killed. It was really pretty simple. If an event happened during the day, somebody was hurt, or we were in a firefight, or we went through a village where there were bodies lying everywhere, if it would strike me forcefully enough in the evening while the rest of the guys kind of clowned around and talked as dark began to come, I'd go into my foxhole and I'd write a page or two about it. It was written, though, as something to find on my body were I to die, so my mom and dad would know what I'd gone through a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise, it would be just dead silence. Your son goes off to a war, and then up comes the army chaplain to deliver news, and there's nothing in between. And I just had this desire for my parents to know at least something of what it had been like, how purposeless it all felt. It was not heading for Berlin or heading for Tokyo. We were just went in circles. We go into a village and search it, and somebody may die or get wounded, and then we'd leave. And then a week later or 3 weeks, we'd come back to the same place and do it again. And there was no sense of destination that my dad felt as in the Navy in World War II, where he was going to Tokyo.
There was a bad guy the world was trying to get rid of.
Yeah.
Well, where did you keep those papers as the war progressed? In your backpack?
I kept them in my rucksack,
Yeah. Let's go to some phone calls here. Again, our guest, Tim O'Brien, The Things They Carried, is his excellent book about the Vietnam War. 816-235-2888 is our number here. Let's go to Jeremy from Lawrence. Jeremy, good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for hosting this. Mr. O'Brien, I wanted to get your perspective on the political aspects of the Vietnam documentary and what was left out of it in terms of the recent investigations into Kennedy's changing relationship with Vietnam, where he was standing up against all of his advisors against escalating it, shown in National Security Documents 263, and why this was left out of this film, and whether this film actually has propaganda aspects to it that protect such elements as the Central Intelligence Agency's Phoenix program of coordinated assassinations, and then potentially whether the actors high up around Kennedy who disagreed with him actually took him out and then reversed his policy. Would you speak to whether you maybe have some responsibility in speaking out against what was left out about the highest levels of treason in our government?
Thank you, Jeremy. Tim?
Well, it's a complicated and important question, and I have all kinds of things to say about it. The first is that Ken and Lynn, the makers of the film, were given 18 hours to tell the story of decades.
So, which is a long time in TV land.
A lot of history. And they've been criticized, just as the caller just did, for leaving things out by others. The difficulty is that every single person has a different thing they've left out. Some people have criticized him for leaving out the children of leftover in Vietnam that have been fathered by GIs. Others have criticized them for leaving out the peace movement that wasn't sufficient. I mean, it was in there, but many people who protested the war felt there wasn't sufficient attention paid to that. I, in my part, felt part of my story had been left out as well. I thought the story of the common infantryman was occasionally sacrificed to the big battle mentality of Way, Tet, Hamburger Hill, and so on, and that just sort of the common guy, as I was, walking without purpose through these villages.
Was there a nefarious aspect of the U.S. government's involvement here that Jeremy's pointing to that might have been included?
Well, in a way, yes. In a way, no. I think that he's right that there was the CIA knew for a long time, as Jeremy mentioned, that there was no light at the end of the tunnel, or didn't seem to be in any case, that there was very little evidence to support the huge body count differentials between the soldiers we were losing and they were losing. And that they weren't listening, and that the CIA was told these things to the two administrations in charge of the war, but that they weren't, that the administrations in both cases, Nixon and Johnson, decided a little callously and cold-bloodedly, in my opinion, that let's win the next election. Let's not lose this war or pull out of this war until we get reelected. And they both said so, both presidents, on tape. And it's in the program. It's in Ken and Lynn's film. So I guess what I'm trying to say is, in general, I think the film did a great service to our country. If nothing else, it did give us the voices of the Vietnamese, which had been almost, I mean, very few Americans,
mm-hmm.
even PBS viewers of the elite,
yeah.
had heard much from the Vietnamese soldiers who had fought that war and the women who had endured the war themselves. And to add that voice all by itself is a fantastic accomplishment and a very difficult accomplishment, mm-hmm. you know, going, flying over to Vietnam and trying to work their way through the bureaucracy to get people who, in some cases, were a little afraid to testify.
Right.
It was hard. It was generally an educative film for the country. It was really good for our country.
And the level of duplicity on the part of our national leaders, both Democrat and Republican, I thought came through pretty clearly.
I thought it did.
It was jaw-dropping at times.
Everybody I talk to, that's what they say. It's mm-hmm. exactly what you said, Steve. They say mm-hmm. that if nothing else, what I got on that film was it was astonishing that two administrations could be so duplicitous for so long, knowing there was no light at the end of the tunnel,
yeah.
and still pursuing the war.
Let's go back to some phone calls here. And Nolan from Lenexa, you're on with Tim O'Brien. Nolan.
Hi, Steve. Hi, Mr. O'Brien.
Hi.
I was just calling because I want to say you've written my favorite book ever. The Things They Carried is my favorite book. I read it first in high school, and I took a copy of it with me to Afghanistan. And I just wanted to thank you for giving me that. And that's really all I had.
Well, thank you so much.
And that's not an unusual story that modern-day soldiers have connected with this book in fairly profound ways, Tim.
It's one of the heartwarming things about being a writer. We think of books sometimes as objects of entertainment or things to study in school.
Mm-hmm.
But sometimes a book can do something in human life that is miraculous. And I almost teared up when the last caller said what he did. I get letters and emails from people who do carry the things they carried around Afghanistan and Iraq. And I also, maybe even more movingly, get letters from the wives and the children of veterans. And they almost always say the same thing. They say, my dad or my boyfriend or my husband or my brother won't talk about it. He just goes silent. But now, having read your book, at least I know something of what he endured.
Yeah, yeah. I should point out that Tim will be speaking this evening at the Kansas City, Missouri Public Library. The event is sold out, but you can watch a streamed live version of it at youtube.com/KC Library. For more information about that, visit kclibrary.org. Just one final thing. Did you have any idea when you wrote this book that its staying power would be what it's turned out to be?
The book was an accident in many ways. I was stuck on another book. It was macabre and grim and hard to finish. I was in a bad place in my life, almost suicidal.
Mm.
And I had to leave it, and I left it to write The Things They Carried, not knowing that The Things They Carried would be The Things They Carried.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted to revisit some of the sources of my depression back in the early 90s. And I thought, well, if you're going to revisit it, you're going to have to begin with the most terrible and the tragic thing. You were a soldier in a war, and it's keeping you awake at night. So it began kind of as an accident.
Hmm. Tim O'Brien, the book again, The Things They Carried. It's the big read selection for the libraries in the Kansas City area. Again, he speaks tonight at the library. It's sold out. You can watch online at youtube.com/KC Library. Tim, you're what you call in the business a great guest. It's just been a pleasure to have you here. Thanks so much for visiting with us today.
I've had a great time.
Thanks very much. Time for a break. When we come back, we're going to switch topics dramatically and talk about the new version of board games and how they're hot properties all of a sudden once again. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And we're back. I'm Steve Kraske. On yesterday's show, Senator Claire McCaskill of Missouri discussed her reelection campaign, and we learned about the experiences of LGBTQ youth in the rural Midwest. You can find those conversations at kcur.org and on the NPR One app. Tomorrow, find out how forensic science is helping to identify deceased undocumented migrants at the border with Mexico. We'll also hear how mass shootings affect the passage of new gun laws. That's tomorrow on KCUR's Up to Date. Well, I bet some of you thought that board games were a relic of the distant past. If you did, you're probably half right. Games like Monopoly and Risk may not have the pop they once did, but a new style of European board games that emphasize strategy while downplaying luck and conflict is a hot commodity these days. In fact, they may be a way to get family and friends unplugged and talking with each other and even help them bond. With us here to talk about this is Denise Dias. She's a family and consumer sciences extension agent with K-State Research and Extension in Johnson County. And Denise, it's so good to have you here. Welcome.
Thank you.
European-style board games, what are we talking about here?
Yeah, you know, typically we think of board games, Monopoly for one, chess,
yes.
Any of those kinds of games.
That's my generation's games.
Yeah,
yes.
Mine as well,
but
too.
But no more, yeah.
Yes, but today's games are a different type of game because they teach kids about, you know, strategy. They teach them about how to interact with one another. And I think in our society today, with so many electronic devices that we have and video games, we've kind of lost some of that connectiveness to other family members.
You're saying
and
it's
people.
Still possible to connect with each other in 2017? We haven't lost that ability because it sure seems like it sometimes.
Yeah, it really is important to be able to connect with one another. And I think even employers in today's job markets are looking for people that have those soft skills, that can communicate, downplay luck and learn how to, you know, manipulate things and just focus on a positive interaction with one another. I think that's really critical.
And you've seen this because the extension service, you guys sponsor these game nights, and you've seen firsthand mm-hmm. how these games can affect people as you watch them.
Right. We've had a couple of events where we've had game nights and had people come in and sit down, maybe learn to play a new style of game, which kind of helps them to get them out of their comfort zone. And, you know, everybody's learning and talking and sharing. And it's been interesting because we've had all ages there. The last game night we had someone there about 5 years old. The oldest person was 87. And it's really neat to see those intergenerational connections being made, them learning to talk to one another socially, sharing values and ideas with one another.
You know, I think of the extension service. That's the place I call when my grass won't grow. What
right.
made you guys think that this would be having game nights would be a good thing to do?
Right. Beyond doing, you know, grass, helping people growing grass.
And that's important.
In their lawns and that sort of thing. We also work in the areas of families, aging issues, those kinds of areas of helping families to connect one another, to encourage those positive bonds and relationships that make that family union so strong.
The next Bonding with Board Games event takes place Friday, November 3rd at the Extension office. That's right. At 11811 South Sunset Drive out in Olathe, right?
Right.
I'll put that out again here in a little bit. Among the games that are out now that seem to be really popular, one of them is Settlers of Catan?
Catan,
uh-huh. Okay. A German board game first published in 1995. Do you know about that game?
Yeah, it was actually one of the first Euro-style board games that was invented. And it kind of started this whole movement of creating new board games for people to use and interact with.
Tell us about it, because it's really a hot property.
Yeah, it is a very hot property. That one, among other board games, things like Apples to Apples, which is also popular with folks. Chicken Cha-Cha-Cha is one that's popular with
kids. I was going to ask
kids.
You about Chicken Cha-Cha-Cha. I just wanted to say it at least
yeah,
once.
Yeah, it's a fun game to say anyway. Yeah. But Chicken Cha-Cha-Cha, for example, is a memory game for kids. And kids learn how to match different pieces together. And while they're moving around the farmyard, if you will, they try and get chicken feathers from their players, and it's just a really interesting game for kids to play. Mm-hmm. So they love that memory aspect. They have to learn how to count. They learn how to follow rules and interact with each other. So no wonder they love it.
These aren't games that necessarily take 6 hours to play, right? Because sometimes you think of Risk or Monopoly, and that was a game we would sit down at 9 o'clock in the morning. We were still there at 4 o'clock in the afternoon. But these games may not fall into that category.
Right. The games are designed to be played fairly quickly, you know, and I think that's
also
appealing
in this day and age. Yeah.
So most games probably last about 15 to 20 minutes on average. I think at our board game night, we had one group that took about 30 minutes to play a game, but that was probably one of the more lengthier games that were played that night.
No kidding.
But, you know, they go pretty fast. They're a lot of fun. People can interact, and if they get tired of one game or it doesn't quite appeal to them, they can find another one to play.
Game developers say Settlers of Catan is a game in which players are always involved. There's no downtime, I read. Mm-hmm. It requires social skills to play cleverly. It's a game that is characterized by creating win-win rather than zero-sum situations. That sound right?
Yeah, that's exactly right. You know, helping to create that positive environment for that game to happen, and also working on strategy. Typically, the players work together to solve a common problem.
Yeah.
Especially in Settlers of Catan, that one for sure. Other board games where, like, how one person, what they do can affect how your game is played.
Mm-hmm.
So that interaction between one another. So instead of having a game where people get mad and upset, it's a more positive outcome. There are winners and losers, but it's a way of teaching people how to be a gracious winner and a gracious loser at the same time.
The other folks who might be listening to this sometimes think of a new game and they think, oh, it's going to take me, you know, a long time to learn how to play this game. Is that mm-hmm. the case with these newfangled games?
Actually, no. Actually, they're very simple to learn how to pick up and just start playing. The rules are very straightforward for many of these games, and they can actually be played, some games, in different manners, too.
And you can dive right in and get going then.
Yep. Yeah. So it doesn't take a long time, or you have to spend a long time reading directions or studying it to figure out how to play a game.
We have a caller here who wants to chime in on these new board games here. Here, Denise, Mark from Lawrence. And Mark, welcome to Up to Date.
Thank you, Steve.
Go ahead.
Well, a few years ago, I played a game with some friends called Puerto Rico. And
Denise is nodding her head, Mark. Yeah.
I know it's rather topical at the moment, Puerto Rico, but it's a great game where you choose every move you make. It's a non-dice game. There may be a slight element of chance in cards you draw for certain commodities that you trade and or develop, but it's a really entertaining game, and it's one of those longer games. It takes couple hours to play, or at least 1 hour, maybe, it seems like. But I just wanted to throw that out there and mention that game.
Mark, can I ask how old you are?
I am 41.
I'm wondering, was it hard for you to disconnect and put the phone down for a while and sort of venture off into a board game?
It's never been like that for me. Huh. I look at my phone about 10 times a day. That's good for you.
Mark, I'm glad you called. Thanks very much.
Thanks, Steve. Enjoy the show.
Thank you. I'm wondering, Denise, is it hard to convince a 22-year-old kid to come in and want to play a board game these days and put the phone down for a while?
Actually, it's not that difficult to do that. I think that people want to do something fun and interesting, and for a 22-year-old to sit down and play a game with a parent or grandparent, I think they're more willing to do that than other activities around the house.
Well, again, the next Extension Office Board Game Night will be Friday, November 3rd. What time? It's like 7 o'clock?
No, it's actually earlier, about 6:30, and we go till 8:30. That way people can have a chance to get a little dinner before they come, and then they can come and relax. But yet it still ends early enough, so if you have little ones, you can get them home, get them to bed.
That Extension Office address, 11811 South Sunset Drive out in Olathe. I have that right?
You do.
That's Denise Dias, a family and consumer sciences extension agent with K-State Research and Extension in Johnson County. Denise, thanks very much. I really appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me today.
Coming up, Brian McTavish and your weekend to-do list.
A love struck Romeo, sing the streets a serenade, laying everybody low with a love song that he made. Find the streetlight, steps out of the shade, says something like, you and me, babe, how about it? Juliet says, hey, it's Romeo, you nearly give me a heart attack. He's underneath the window, she's singing, Leila, my boyfriend's back. You shouldn't come around here singing up at people like that. Anyway, what you gonna do about it? Juliet, the dice was loaded.
Good song. Brian McTavish just brought us that. Comes in every week to talk about cool stuff to do on your weekend. And welcome back.
That
good
one
to see you.
Still works. That's the Dire Straits take
on good,
isn't it? Romeo and Juliet.
Yeah.
That'll still bubble up the emotions and cause the tears to fall. That song plus countless other, Steve, iterations, interpretations, reimaginings.
And we're talking about Romeo and Juliet.
The classic Romeo and Juliet written by William Shakespeare. Well, one of those things that has happened to Romeo and Juliet over the centuries is people have interpreted it in many mediums, including dance. And that includes the 60th season opener for the Kansas City Ballet. They're doing Romeo and Juliet.
That's why we're talking about this.
Well, yes.
Yeah.
Yes, I mean, that is the ostensible reason.
But and to listen to this song.
Well,
again.
But that's why it's powerful. I mean, whether you look, if you're a fan of ballet, go see Romeo and Juliet, right? If you're not, go see Romeo and Juliet because it's the ultimate tale of star-crossed, ill-fated, if you will, lovers who, in this version, kick up their heels before, spoiler warning, Steve, kicking off. I don't think I'm giving too much away. They don't make it.
Yes.
These kids don't make it out of the play or the ballet alive. And that's just the transcendent power of this thing because there's something endlessly inspirational and promising about young love, but also potentially dangerous, right? Because if you give everything, everything, to this one person, and you value them even more than your 15-year-old life itself, well, hey, be careful out there,
that's
kids.
Brian McTavish's philosophy of love just spelled out in 30 seconds.
And
beautifully done.
Well, yes, thank you very much, yes.
Day by day.
Great song.
Oh, yeah.
Terrific. Yeah,
yeah,
I haven't heard that one in a long time.
Well, I'm happy to help. Happy.
Yeah.
So that was the hit song that came out of Godspell.
Right.
Right? And Godspell was a stage musical. Well, let me just say, long before Stephen Schwartz was Wicked, right? Because he had the big hit with Wicked, the take on The Wizard of Oz. Schwartz, the famous lyricist composer, actually had a biblical Broadway hit in 1971 or 72. With Godspell, and I was thinking about this. I guess we should also mention that's kind of why we're here. You can see Godspell at 7:30 tonight and Friday, or 2 and 7:30 Saturday, or 2 o'clock Sunday afternoon at the Johnson County Arts and Heritage Center.
The new Johnson County Arts,
the brand new spanking thing, And this is actually part of Theater in the Park. You know, out at Shawnee Mission Park, they have an indoor aspect. And so you can go see this very inspirational show inside at Johnson County Arts and Heritage Center. But just real briefly, I was thinking about this, and Godspell, where did this come from? Like, why all this? Well, it was part of that late 60s, early 1970s trend to present entertainments to primarily young people with a more or less religious or spiritually curious theme. It was as if the counterculture, sort of a subgenre of truth-seeking going on out there. You know, so-called Jesus freaks, kind of a pejorative term, but sincerely speaking, people searching for something bigger than themselves.
And they're still searching.
Well, they sure are, and Godspell is part of that.
Be sure to see Brian's six dramatic things to do in Kansas City this weekend. Just go to kcur.org.
Well, I know it gets harder every single day. And I know my darkness will never go away. But it's hard when you're living and you don't feel much, and you're down and you're hoping that things are gonna change.
He's picking great music this week, man.
Oh, we're on a roll.
Good.
Your approval is sterling to have, my friend.
What do we have here?
Well, okay, that's the Strumbellas, and they're one of the bands that are going to be on stage for Fed Up Fest, the hunger-fighting music festival that will benefit Harvester's Community Food Network. And so I'm sure they'll do this. It's called We Don't Know, and it's appropriate for talking about this event, which takes place from 2:30 in the afternoon till 11 at night on Saturday at Crossroads KC at Grinders downtown, because a tune like this starts out rather haunting and what's going to happen next, but has hope in it. So go see the Strumbellas, the Cowboy Mouth, Me Like Bees, the Fantastics, and others. The whole point is money from tickets and so forth goes toward feeding kids and families right here in KC who are hungry and need to be fed.
Very cool. And now even more music.
Okay.
We all know this song, too. And this is an entry to
Well,
Porch Fest.
I can't say that Porch Fest KC, which is from noon to 6 o'clock Saturday in the Roanoke, Valentine, and Volker neighborhoods.
It's such a cool event.
Oh, it's such a cool event. Deal. Yeah, go to these three Midtown neighborhoods. You'd like to think that somebody among the pickers and grinners there, hundreds of musicians on nearly 50 front porches, will do dueling banjos.
Probably.
Which actually is a guitar and a banjo. I never got that misnomer. But hopefully somebody will pick up a banjo and a guitar and make that happen
That's
at Porch Fest.
It's not two banjos. It's a guitar and a banjo.
Yeah, well.
Whatever.
Dueling banjo has a nicer ring to it.
Details.
Yeah.
and finally today. It's that time of year again.
It is.
Spooky time.
We still have some weeks left where we can spooky things on this segment.
Yeah.
But let's do one right now. Okay, so have you heard of or seen the work of legendary Italian horror movie director Mario Bava?
I have not.
All right, you're going to get a chance to soak it up. There's a brand new Thursday Night Film Fest series. It takes place at the Tivoli Cinema in Westport.
Mm.
And the first one up tonight at 7 o'clock is Black Sunday from 1960. That's Mario Bava's, one of his B-movie masterpieces. It stars Barbara Steele as a fetching witch who does not like being burned at the stake one little bit.
I don't blame her.
One little bit. And other films coming up on Thursdays to come, The Whip and the Body with Christopher Lee, Black Sabbath with Boris Karloff, and Kill Baby Kill.
And that's Brian McTavish and your weekend to-do list. Thanks, Brian.
Have a wonderful weekend.
On tomorrow's show, a forensic anthropologist who works to identify remains of undocumented migrants along the border. That's on tomorrow's KCUR Up to Date. Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, Coy Duggar, and Justin Garnett produced this show. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.